Welcome to a special Christmas episode of Pluxcast, episode 6, with our good friend Sydney Nash, where we're going to talk about some of the differences between doing government affairs work at national, Brussels, but international level, because Sydney is involved in some of the policymaking and advocacy that's taking place at global level around various public health issues. So over to you, Sydney, to introduce yourself. Who are you? What do you do? Why are you here?
Great. Thanks, Patrick, and Merry Christmas. So, Sydney Nash. Spent a lot of time working with you in the automotive sector in the UK on Brexit and international trade. Before that, I was in-house, so working in government, civil servant for 10 years, working on EU-level policy, but also national and local. And now I'm doing a global role. So I've tried to kind of work at each level, either in-house in government or not now kind of outside of government, both in Brussels, now Geneva, and a bit of Washington and New York as well. So hopefully get a good perspective for you.
Excellent. I think that's really interesting that you've got insight at all these levels. To a starting question, what's the biggest difference from your point of view between how you do advocacy and government affairs work at the international Geneva level as compared to the national level? Is it less political? Is it more technical? What are the stakeholders that are involved? Just give us a sense of how it works, because I think a lot of our listeners here in Brussels don't really know how the global public affairs world operates.
I mean, it's always political. It doesn't matter which level you're working at, it's always political. But I say political in a slightly different way at the global level. You're dealing with diplomats, primarily speaking. They approach things in a slightly different way. They have a longer-term view. They're not unaffected by electoral cycles, but it's not like dealing with MPs. It's not like dealing with individuals who are looking over their shoulder to a constituency, thinking about the next election, thinking about locals, by-elections, etc., etc. So you get a slightly different type of conversation as a result. I'd say there's similarities with what you get in Brussels when you're working with officials in Brussels, but maybe just another step removed from the politics. Now, that waxes and wanes over time, of course. You know, the bigger the issue on the table, the more political it gets. And indeed, the bigger the issue, the more multidimensional the chess game is, I'd say, when you're working at the international level compared to perhaps the national level. There's so many different interests at play, and it's quite hard to read it. I'm still relatively new to it at the global level, so for me, it's still quite hard to read. I'm getting there, though.
So would you be considering the positions of different countries when you're formulating your advocacy plan and things like that, or...?
So I think, yes, one's always going to think about different constituencies, different countries' positions, different positions within those countries. I think one of the things you learn working, you know, at the EU level and the international level is governments don't all speak with one voice, and that's one of the challenges. So yes, one's absolutely kind of considering that and trying as best as one can to kind of get ahead of the trends and the shifts and the changes. It's not a science. I wouldn't necessarily say it as an art either. I think it's a bit of a hit and miss, trial and error process. So you know, understand the political cycle, understand the electoral cycle. In the countries that matter most to you, know people on the ground. I mean, there's a limit to how much any individual, any organisation can actually really know. I know UK politics, I'm British. I know EU politics, I've worked in Brussels, but I don't know Japanese politics, I don't know Argentinian politics. One's got to rely on other people. So you've got to build a big network, get trusted experts, listen to a lot of people. In fact, listen more than you talk, I'd say, is the key thing.
I think it's fascinating about that point you're making about building a massive network, but doing that at a global level must be incredibly challenging. So how do you go about doing that? Is there at an international level, an equivalent to Brussels? Because the thing about Brussels is everybody comes together, they're in one place, you're meeting people organically in Place Lux or wandering around the parliament. Is Geneva that equivalent or is it different? Do you have to make an effort to go out to other countries to build that network?
I would say Geneva, my caveat to answering this is that, you know, I started my current role during COVID lockdowns. So my experience of Geneva as it normally is still limited. But my sense is it's not as talky a town as Brussels is. It doesn't have the same broad network of kind of think tanks, kind of academic associations, in addition to the permanent representatives and the officials. It feels like more of a diplomatic city. So there isn't like a Place Lux equivalent. You can't kind of hang out outside a coffee shop and hope to meet most of the people you need to meet, I think, in Geneva. So it's a slightly different atmosphere from that perspective. That said, similarities will be, you know, this is where the technical discussions are happening, it's where the policy formulation is taking place, when the big meetings are taking place, when the ministers are in town. So it has that same kind of convening feel to it that Brussels has, but I think on a day-to-day basis it feels slightly different to how it works works here in Brussels.
So does that mean that there's much more importance on being in the room? Because here in Brussels, you know, you try to get the permaps to say anything, and it's not that they don't want to, but they can't say anything, really. So if you're saying Geneva's more diplomatic, does that, do you still have that kind of, we don't really want to say anything in public effect, or...?
Not necessarily. I think it just requires... It requires time in the city, and I think that what I found with all these roles is you need to put in the time to have non-transactional discussions and build the relationship. So certainly when I was working in government, to kind of go back to the pressures on ministers, they've got a ticking clock, a ticking electoral clock, and they want to get straight into the transactional meetings. I don't know if that's a uniquely British thing, but I certainly felt that of UK ministers. And it took a while to kind of persuade, and you've got to put a bit of time in where you're sitting down and just having a coffee. And your objective is to come out having secured another meeting and a generally warm atmosphere around the conversation. And I think one has to do that in Geneva and build those relationships. The diplomats are there for a long period of time, the technical level, you know, it's a lifer type job. And that's where the conversations happen. Ultimately, though, when it comes to the discussions around the table, a bit like when you're having discussions around the council table here in Brussels, there's so many different players inputting into it, many of which aren't in Brussels or in Geneva. They're back in capital, and it's partly the foreign ministry, it's partly the industry ministry, the agricultural ministry. So there's so many different kind of individuals at play, and understanding each of those and how one should interact with them is complicated. So to go back to your question, Patrick, well, how do you do it then at a global level? You can't boil the ocean. You've got to pick the countries that matter, pick the issues that matter, and then build around that. So a bit of kind of strategic forward thinking, and really look to the long horizon. So one of the big shifts I found is if my time in government felt like a 2-year cycle, you know, even with 5-year elections, still like a 2-year cycle of work, the horizons now on kind of UN level work is you're talking 10-year programs, 15-year programs. It's a very different time frame than one's working within. So in some ways you have more time to build those relationships, I think.
And just going back to sort of the nitty-gritty of how you do engagement at international level, here in Brussels it's all about the position paper, isn't it? You agree a position paper, that's a set of messages, and then the job is how do you deliver those messages into stakeholders, whether through direct engagement in meetings or doing more public-facing comms. Is it similar at the international level? What are some of the tools of engagement? Is it position papers? Is it more public communications? Or is it really those being in those face-to-face meetings with the experts?
I think some of the tools are the same. I think those principles of how you engage are the same. And then finding the right way to communicate to the right individual. So it's going to be a combination of talking, a combination of papers. I think all those tools still apply at the international level, responding to the process when there's a consultation, all that kind of stuff. I think that's core in any structure, really. It doesn't really change.
I mean, that's a key thing, isn't it? I mean, I remember being lobbied by you a few years ago, and you, Patrick, by the way. Everything can be boiled down to a process, right? Mm. If you want to be a good lobbyist, would you say step one is to just look at the process and follow it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you've got to understand success comes with getting in early, right? You've got to get in when the ideas are embryonic, the analysis hasn't been done yet, the data hasn't been done yet. That's when you can really help inform and frame decision making. So that means you've got to understand that legislative process, or that policy making process, and really kind of get to the front end of it. And those who are really good at it in Brussels kind of get when that forward planning is being done, how to kind of hear what's starting to get put into a work program, thinking now in 2022, what's the discussion going to be in 2025? That's how you kind of really get ahead of the game. So on the one hand, it's like, okay, understand the process of the legislators, the policymakers, the politicians, and what the kind of the key milestones are in that. Then working back from the starting gun on it, okay, how do we get our thinking done in advance? So when they start their thinking, we've already, in effect, kind of completed ours. We know what the outcome is that we want. We've done our analysis. We know how to be useful in the conversation. I think being facilitative in the discussions really helps kind of build a relationship that's worthwhile, and that a policymaker will kind of come back to you and trust you and recognise you're a valuable partner, because essentially they're all time shy. Yeah, they don't know all the answers. They're going to work with people who are helping facilitate where they're trying to get to. Now, of course, there are going to be times when you're fundamentally opposed to what they're trying to do. You're not always going to be able to be good cop. But even then, still getting right in the beginning of the process, I think, is absolutely key. And I don't think that changes in any setting. I think a lot of what one sees is situations when organizations, be they company, trade association, governments, are trying to put the genie back in the bottle. And it's like, yeah, the problem is you're kind of 2 years too late. So this is why this looks really difficult. This is why the conversations are so awkward and frosty, and the relationships are so kind of prickly. It's because we come to this too late. We've come to it too late because we just weren't really looking closely enough, early enough, and didn't understand the process well enough. And I think that's really fundamental.
And just before you come in, Patrick, I know you're burning to ask a question, but we saw that with Apple this week, didn't we? They stormed out of the meeting with the commission, said they're going to go their own way and do their own thing. Well, that's not building a relationship, is it? That's ending a relationship.
No, indeed.
So the next time they have to lobby the commission on something, what are they going to do? They're going to get through the door.
Yeah, exactly. And as you were saying, Sid, it's about that. You need those non-transactional meetings to build the relationships, to build a reputation and a brand. That's so important. That's almost the bulk of the work. So that when you do come with a specific request, the stakeholders are open and willing to hear from you. But I think you're one of our first guests to actually have experience in government. So, you know, we'll take advantage of that. And just from the side of being on the other side of the desk from the lobbyist, being an official, what is it that you look for or would have looked for from business representatives when they came to see you? What is it that we as government affairs people need to be delivering to officials to help them in their way forward? And I think that's the way we approach it, isn't it? It's not about being abrasive or being aggressive. It's about how do we add value to the process. So your thoughts on that would be
interesting. I think that adding value point is key. I mean, as an official, you basically want people to make your life easier, not harder. I mean, who doesn't want that, right? And I think those are really effective they've already thought it through from your perspective as an official. They've got a bit of a recognition of what the political pressures or economic pressures or generally understanding, you know, what is your room for manoeuvre in this situation. So it's no use kind of sitting down an official and saying, well, you want to go down pathway A, but actually we need you to go down pathway Z. And it's like, well, that's great. But if you've not read the government's manifesto, it says pathway A. We're not going to change this now. So let's kind of get onto the same track here. So that understanding of the limitations of what is possible, a bit of empathy, I guess, right? This is all done on a human level. So a bit of empathy. Then I think moving on from that, you really want those who are engaging with you to fully thought it through themselves. Because your time is short. You're likely to maybe only have one meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, and let's assume that actually you're only going to have one meeting. If you do it well, you'll get more, right? Because you've done a good job. So you really want somebody who can get their point across, so you understand exactly what their position is, and they can back it up with some evidence and data. Now, I know, you know, it's maybe gone a bit out of fashion in recent years, actually having the evidence and having the data, but yeah, I still think ultimately that's what makes the case, right? And you keep in mind, so I'm thinking about this from a UK perspective, but I'm sure it applies in other countries as well. You know, what's that official going to be doing after that meeting? You know, they're doing at most a page and a half, maybe 2 pages, that go up to a minister with some advice in a box that's packed full of other stuff. Your issues, if you're lucky, it's a sentence or two. That's what you're kind of aiming to get in, just to kind of shift the dial a bit. You're not going to get a fundamental rewrite of the policy, but you want to be in that piece of paper. But just kind of keeping in mind, well, what's the process they're operating within here? You know, how much authority does this individual have to really change the world? Or are they really just instructed to deliver on what's been asked of them? And have that level of empathy and do your homework, do your own analysis, come with the answers already. I think if you do all of that, the official then kind of comes back to you because they're still looking for evidence. They're still looking for data. They want to present policy that's as well thought out and formulated as possible. So if you're able to help them in doing that, you're going to keep on having the door open to you, even if you disagree. And I think that's a really important point. Still have the conversation, even if you disagree, because ultimately the politics decides and the minister decides and the minister's elected, which means the voters decide, and that's democracy. We all have to kind of live with that. But do keep having a conversation, even if you don't agree, actually. I think that's really key as well.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And I think the point you're making about, in the end, it's the politics that decides. I think that's sometimes the challenge we have as government affairs people working in corporate environments is we get instructions from, you know, that originate from an engineering department or a business department saying we need this. But part of our job is almost to feed back into the business and say, well, this is actually the Overton window of what the politics will allow. And Absolutely. We know the business wants X, but it's just outside the scope of what what the politics is. So we almost have a job to feed back in and say, here's the scope within which we can operate.
Mm.
And if we go in to see officials and ministers with a demand that's just completely outwith, we're not going to get anywhere. So we need to also compromise a bit.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Drawing on my own experience too, from my time in the parliament, you'd have these organisations rock up and their major ask would be, oh, just stop what the commission's doing.
if only it were that easy. Yeah.
What are you meant to do with that ask? So perhaps maybe if I could just forge this into a question. So for people like us, how do we tell vice presidents, CEOs, no, this is unachievable?
Yeah. It's probably the most difficult question you've asked actually so far. So I think that is challenging. And again, it's like understanding their perspective and the limitation of how much time they're focusing on these particular issues. You know, obviously, what they want is the problem solved and to never hear from you again, kind of ideally. I think, I guess, in some ways, it's about, you know, you guys are more experienced about working in a business than I am, but I think in some ways it's about the culture within the business and almost that internal understanding of the politics. So I think when we're in our world, I mean, we're all political geeks, right? All political and policy geeks. And you naively think everybody's the same, but you realise actually most people have a life, right? And I think that's the same in any organisation. So you kind of need to do that internal outreach through the kind of, I guess, the right hierarchical structure up to the CEO of understanding the politics. Yeah, maybe it's a quarterly brief or whatever. It's your own internal assessment and analysis of where things are shifting and what it might mean for the business, which means before you then get that request of just make this go away or just make this happen, you can then draw back on, well, yeah, but just remember what we've been telling you about, the way the tectonic plates have been shifting. So when I say to you, actually, that's not possible, it's because of all these things we've already set out. So, I mean, I guess in some ways, all my answers are a bit kind of, you've got to do this stuff early and nothing can really be done overnight. So it's about levels of understanding. It's about preparation. It's about kind of getting a culture of understanding of politics in an organisation. And then you just got to keep on refreshing it because people, personnel change, CEOs change, the politics changes. It's an ongoing conversation. I think that's the other thing. It's like embed it into the culture of the organisation. I mean, if I could just like say one more thing on this and you guys will be able to reflect on it yourself. Like looking back at my time in automotive, I think that was a extraordinary politics boot camp for to come, and not just auto, for all kind of business in the UK, where kind of the scale started to fall from their eyes and they really started to look at the politics and understand that the politics decides. It should be the evidence, it should be practice, whatever, as the politics decides. And I could sense, looking back on it now, I can kind of see that learning curve that people were going on from, say, 2016 up to 2020, where their fundamental understanding of how this whole thing worked changed. Going from a point of, I think these politicians broadly know what they're talking about, but I disagree with them, to actually know maybe they don't know what they're talking about. Oh my God, maybe even their civil servants don't know what they're talking about. I need to educate them. And now I can be a bit more relaxed about some of the ups and downs. So I know this is nonsense, but I still see the big strategic threat. And I think they all went on a bit of a journey, which then allowed by the end, I think for people like yourself, Patrick, you'll tell me if I'm right or wrong, people like me to say, no, that's not achievable. Mm. For all the things you've learned over this period of time. But that's like a 4-year, like pretty painful education of the realities of politics. I wouldn't kind of prescribe that medicine for everybody necessarily.
No, but I think you're spot on. That period of time was, I think political boot camp is exactly the right way to put it. But I think it also emphasises, to toot our own horn, the value of companies having a government affairs function. Mm. Not just a regulatory function or a sensing function or something that's very technical, but providing the organisation with that broader political picture and awareness of the trends. And I think the world is not going to get any less volatile or uncertain.
Yeah.
In you know, we see the big geopolitical issues, and sometimes, you know, a European senior management will go, why are you briefing me on the Taiwan situation?
Mm.
Well, actually, because if we look at it, that's going to have a direct business impact on our supply chains or whatever it might be. So I think that regular political update is useful in educating senior management on the importance of politics, particularly in a global company as well, where sometimes people are looking at what's happening in Europe or the UK from the other side of an ocean, seeing it through a different lens and having that cut through and saying, this is exactly what's happening.
It's the politics that's missing in the title. It should be government and political affairs,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what about Brussels then? Mm. So how long did you spend in Brussels?
So I only had a brief period of time working in the commission. I did a stage atypique, so I was only here for 6 months, but that was kind of the precursor to me then going back to London to do an EU-focused role. So I did 6 months in what was then DG Enterprise, is now DG Grow. And then worked on better regulation with an EU focus. So having kind of lifted ideas from the Dutch and the Danes about better regulation, the UK is then trying to, we kind of embedded it domestically, and then we wanted the EU to kind of take these things forward. So that's kind of the focus of my work. And then come 2010, I shifted to lead on single market policy, so with the coalition. So working to Vince Cable when he was Secretary of State for Business, wrote the single market strategy, not on my own, of course, you know, many, many other people involved back in 2010, and then moved on to strategic engagement. So in some ways, actually doing, from a UK government perspective, the kind of Brussels lobbying that, you know, you guys do from a company perspective. And then in total, I guess I did like 6 years in government, focus on Brussels and the EU, either here in Brussels or working from London on Brussels matters. And I decided I'm done with all of that. I want to work on new technology, data-driven manufacturing, autonomous vehicles, great. I'll go to the auto sector, get this new job. Then that thing happened in June 2016. I spent another 5 years working on EU matters. But that's just the way it is.
So in that kind of role of being externally not present in Brussels, I assume you had to parachute yourself in, basically.
Yeah.
And there's many people who listen to this show who are in exactly that position. I mean, they live in Slovakia, and they do government affairs in Slovakia, but they come to Brussels once a month or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, Patrick, you
did that.
You live in Slovakia. Yeah, a lot of change.
so how do you cope with that? Because a lot of the value to having a Brussels presence is just being in the room. Mm-hmm. It's about having those water cooler conversations, the stuff you can't get from a very measured and quick visit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some ways I was in a bit of a privileged position because I started doing this in the government. So I guess two points, one of which, when I was working here, I knew the policy well, so I basically spent the time networking and meeting people. And of course, when I was back in the government, I had the massive resources of the UK per rep to support me and frankly kind of, you know, spot the mistakes and iron out the creases and fill in the cracks before we actually went and said anything in the council chamber. As a result, it was quite easy to kind of drop in and plug in because, you know, we had a massive team there. Like no company's going to be that well resourced kind of coming out to Brussels. And I guess consequently, I had a ready-made network for when I was then doing this from an auto sector. So it was quite easy for me to come in and get doors to be opened up because I knew all the perm reps. So in some ways, I was a bit lucky. How would I go about doing it if I had none of that and I was kind of starting from scratch? I think in truth, you do have to put a bit of time just kind of being in Brussels. Make use, I mean, there's plenty of expertise in the city, right? So, you know, make use of the expertise that's already there. It doesn't always come cheap, but they can help open doors. They can help broker the right discussions, help one to start building that relationship. And frankly, if you're based in Europe, it's easy enough to get to Brussels. It's not all that expensive to do it and spend the time. And then I think it goes back to understanding the process, understand the calendar. So you come at the right moments and you spend the time with the right people at the right moments. I think it's easy enough to build up. You need to be an extrovert. You know, you need to be willing to do dinners. You need to be happy to have the coffee, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess the other element I'd say to it is like, don't ignore Strasbourg. So it's easy to do everything in Brussels. But of course, with the parliament, you got to play in both cities. And in some ways, there's a case to be made for it's better to do your parliamentary stuff in Strasbourg because it's more fish in a barrel and you can just focus your own time more. Now, I found when you're in Brussels, it's hard not to have your time pulled in all directions of all the institutions because you're in the city. So get the MEPs when they're in Brussels. When they're in Strasbourg and when they're in Brussels. So I think that'd be my advice. We do need to kind of put time in on the ground. I don't think you can do it completely remotely.
And is it similar at the Geneva level? Because I think, you know, you said when you came into Brussels, you had that ready-made network, but then having moved into a more Geneva-focused role, have you found that you've had to build that network? And you were saying Geneva's less of a coffee-drinking, chatty shop. So So how have you overcome that hurdle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly the same in Geneva, and I think it's the same in New York with the UN as well. You've got to meet people. My experience has been peculiar because I've had 2 years of limited to no travel because of COVID. So funnily enough, some of this stuff has just had to be done over Zoom. So, I mean, you know, if all else fails, you know, at least get on a video conference with people. And ultimately, I mean, this is still to be tried and tested, if I'm honest with you. Those principles still apply. Kind of get out to the city and meet people. And I guess the beauty of it is you meet one person, they introduce you to two others. They introduce you to another two. And it's very quick how your network your network spreads. So, you know, if you're like me, and frankly, you want to make a living out of having coffee and having nice chats, this is the job for you, right?
I think we can all agree on that.
Well, actually, there's a serious point to be drawn from that, which is kind of how you put having a coffee with someone into a measurable achievement for whoever's paying you, right? Because we understand that that has a huge value. But then even as a cultural aspect, because we are three Anglo-cultured people, but if you go speak to a French person or an Italian person and they're saying, well, what's the value? They have a completely different frame of mind.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's a really good point. And if you haven't worked in this world, you know, if you're in the world of doing kind of like real work, negotiating contracts, you know, drawing up budgets, engineering a new car, making sure it's produced on time to budget, etc., this could seem a bit wasteful, right? How do I put this into the spreadsheet? I think the best way to make the case is really to be able to tell stories about how it's worked. So you know, that's obviously harder for people who are right at the beginning of their career. But I think when you've been doing this for a period of time, you can point to all these examples when that meeting looked like it wasn't relevant. In fact, it looked like it wasn't relevant to my previous employer. This wasn't even on your dollar. But it's that person who got me this intel, which opened up that door, which has got that result for us. So being able to kind of draw those lines. So, you know, I think one of the things to do is if you're in this world, to kind of constantly be thinking about the stories and the times when that has worked, because the path is never linear. This is the thing. I mean, it's humanity. It's kind of chaotic, right? So the paths are always very peculiar. And sometimes you can only really see how it happened after it's happened. It's hard to necessarily see it going forward. And then ultimately, you do need sympathetic people above you to recognize the value of that. And yeah, that's not always going to be the case. Some will believe this is pointless nonsense. We shouldn't be putting the money into it. And then 6 years down the line, they get a series of bad directory decisions. Someone said, why is this? It's like, oh, you cut the budget there. And then you kind of go back to where you started. And you know, humans learn from their mistakes or don't learn from their mistakes. I think we see that cycle in all. Strata society, right?
What a lovely Christmas present for people. How to tell your boss that champagne receptions.
Exactly.
In these tough economic times, are you mad?
So, thank you so much for your time. It's been super interesting, and especially for me, like learning more about that kind of Geneva aspect, which I've never even begun to scratch the surface of. Super interesting. Do you have anything to plug? How can our thousands of listeners follow you, find you? Are you writing any books or anything like that?
Certainly not writing any books. I have nothing to plug. Listen to the podcast. I mean, you already listen to it because you're hearing me say this, but tell your friends. That's my plug.
Brilliant, thanks.